Chapter 9. The plague on livestock. You might in your Bible catch the word. Kate, what was the word you came across? Murrain. Murrain. An old-fashioned word for whatever this was. What's a pretty terrible disease on livestock, especially on cattle and sheep? I think anthrax would be the scariest. I think, is it Larry, is that what you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, anthrax. I agree. For your farm animals, it's just terrifying. There are other things, hoof and mouth. There are other things that are scary, but anthrax is whatever this was. And it could have been a miraculous plague that was unique to Egypt. That's always a possibility. But this would have been very nasty. I have something called rinder pest, crysipelas, foot and mouth, anthrax, or streptococcus. I'm sorry. I got those from a commentary that different, but all of those are possibilities here. But the thing about your animals and disease is that for people who work with animals, whose investment is in their animals, that's everything to that family. If the animal gets sick, what are you going to do? And if an animal is diseased also, you can't eat it, right? There's not much you can do with it. Because really, to stop the disease, you don't even get to benefit from saving like the hide. You got to burn it, right? So most likely, you can't do anything with this critter. So, and it's just heartbreaking. So the plague on livestock.
And they also worship those animals. So
the Egyptians, yeah, yeah. So God kills their gods. I was going to mention this. Thank you for bringing that up. I was thinking about this last night as I was studying. Moses doesn't mention the names of the Egyptian gods. Have you noticed that? We talked about this last time. There have been people like Adersheim who have tried to equate each of the plagues as an attack against a particular Egyptian god or a group of Egyptian gods, so that God kind of undoes all of the Egyptian gods. And that might be a worthwhile study for somebody, but shouldn't we also notice that Moses doesn't do that? That Moses won't or doesn't? You know, what word should I be using here? Why does Moses not tell us the names of the Egyptian gods? Well, what's the first commandment? Do not have any other gods at all. And Moses won't even let them come out of his lips. He will sometimes talk about the gods of the Amorites, the gods of the Moabites, and so forth. But it's the prophets will talk about their names. You know, Isaiah and Jeremiah, I don't have a problem with mentioning Chemosh or the Baals and things like that. But if somebody Moses is writing about, like Naaman the Syrian, if he mentions gods by names, but Moses himself, especially here in the plagues, will not mention the Egyptian gods, I wonder if Moses, who is so careful about what he writes, if he wants the names of those gods to just die. You know, why should we bother with all of these? Let them just die. There might be some wonderful, profound wisdom there. It's not wrong to talk about heresy. We have to sometimes. Paul does it in the New Testament. John certainly does it in the New Testament. Peter, James, and Jude do it in the New Testament. Jesus does it. He'll talk about the yeast of the Pharisees and the Sadducees, right? He'll talk about their false doctrine. But there comes a point where you don't want to describe the false doctrine too carefully, because people being people, You don't want people to remember the false doctrine and think that that was correct doctrine. So there's that problem with probing into... It's one thing that it bothered me about some of my college classes was having to probe too deeply into other religions and denominations and having, why do we have to study the Mormons so intensely? You know, and write papers about them on all of this. And but then you meet them and you realize we have to make sure that our people don't fall into this. One of the first men I ever met in New Ulm was a Jehovah's Witness. And he wanted to talk with me about Jesus. And I said, sure. And we talked together, and I ended up meeting with him on a pretty regular basis. We ended up meeting about twice a month. And I met with him actually over in the Jehovah's Witness Kingdom Hall, which is how I found out that they have windows. Just kind of a myth about Kingdom Halls and about ours in particular. His story was this. He had belonged to a Lutheran church here in New Ulm, not of our fellowship, but a different Lutheran. I think it was Our Savior's, but I'm not sure. And he told me that he had asked, when he was in his days as a Lutheran, he had been a part of the leadership of his congregation and asked his pastor, could you start teaching Bible classes? And the pastor's response was, it's always so much work and nobody ever comes. It doesn't do anybody any good. And this went on for a couple of years where he kept begging the pastor, can you please, I'll buy materials. You just have to lead the class. I'll make the coffee. I'll get the room ready. Please, can we have a Bible study? And the pastor there just kept refusing. And one day after one of these refusals, ding dong, the Jehovah's Witnesses show up at his door and say, we'd like to study the Bible with you. And he took it almost as a sign. They want to do it, my pastor won't do it, so I'll go there. And what happened? His whole family, the whole kit and caboodle, they all became members of the local Jehovah's Witnesses, and he became one of their most aggressive outreach guys, knocking on doors and talking to people. And he and I decided to read the Gospel of Mark together. I sat down with him week after week after week. It was about an hour every Thursday or Friday for weeks on end. We carefully went through the Gospel of Mark. He had some kind of smattering of beginner's Greek, as a lot of Jehovah's Witnesses do. And if I would try to correct him, he wouldn't believe me. You know, well, you've only had 8 years of Greek, but I've had 8 days, you know, and that kind of thing. And I say that kind of flippantly, but that's kind of the attitude that you find. He would not. And I found that a lot of his theology was still kind of leftover Lutheran. And so that's my hope for him, my prayer for him. That whatever's there will still kind of stick with him. But sometimes it helps to learn about these other religions because it helps you do some evangelism. Talk to Norma Schmidt about her work among the Mormons. You know, when they were doing the big campaign, Are You Feeling Worthy? Because that's the big Mormon sense, is you have to feel worthy. And of course, we're not worthy. So learning about that helps can help to make an inroad there, and so forth. But there, I could go on and on about this kind of thing. But I just wanted to point out that Moses doesn't mention the gods of Egypt, and it might be worth studying. But Moses doesn't. So let my people go, so they may worship me. If you refuse to let them go and continue to hold them back, the hand of the Lord will bring a terrible plague on your livestock in the field, on your horses, donkeys, and camels, and on your sheep, I'm sorry, on your cattle, sheep, and goats. Six, right? A definite list here. But the Lord will make a distinction between the livestock of Israel and that of Egypt. so that no animal belonging to the Israelites will die. We don't have a record of this, but I wondered a little bit, is that the naughty boy? If an Israelite had lent an animal to an Egyptian, would all the other ones die and not the one that was just on loan or something like that? And I suppose that's true. But I wanted to just run through quickly here the likely uses for these animals. For a horse, horses were used mainly for what in Egypt in this time?
Chariots.
Chariots, mostly for pulling in a military sense. Horses are for speed and strength. So military use. Donkeys is mostly for, well, I'll call it business transportation. Camels, more for distant trade because they have the longevity to get through things. Cattle are for milk and for the best food of all. Although the Egyptians and the people of India have different religions, and I'm not sure about Egypt and beef. But it doesn't make a big difference. Sheep are a better food, but not the best food. And goat, the poorer food, but hardier. Goats also sometimes used as a poor man's transport. A goat cart could pull things around. You know, your little red wagon or what have you. So what areas of Egyptian life would be affected by allowing harm to come to these animals? Almost everything, yeah. Commerce, the military, the homes, the farms, in town, almost everything. And also their food stocks and things like that. The Lord set a time and said, tomorrow the Lord will do this in the land. And the next day the Lord did it. All the livestock of the Egyptians died, but not one animal belonging to the Israelites died. So that how this was possible that the Israelites' animals did not perish. I mean, they were in Goshen, so they're separated by a branch of the river, but this is the hand of God, isn't it? As the Egyptians said, the finger of God. Later on?
Yeah,
that's a good question. However, he's the wealthiest man in the world. So probably trade. And it's possible that this was afflicting things that are basically in the Nile, and that upriver down south, he had stores of animals like horses that were not affected by this. And later on, the Egyptians are able to pull out some animals, even though we had this one. So did they have an influx of animals that they were able to get them? Or were not? That's not really explained. And I'm willing to let that just sit there. So, did I see a hand? No.
Well, you just have put in there that all the animals died, all the ones who contact the disease died. But isn't that the same thing? All the animals died?
Probably.
They all had contact with the disease?
Yeah. Yes?
Just another one. Couldn't they have gone out and stolen animals from other places?
Well, there's always a sinful answer to everything. So, yeah, they could have stolen. They could have conscripted. What is it? What do you call it when Napoleon walks through the town and takes all your horses? He confiscates or whatever. Yeah, something like that. Conscripted is a word that I would have used. What would have happened to Israel as a nation if God had allowed all their animals to have died in Egypt? I suppose he would have found them animals from somewhere else. Go to Midian and trade some of the gold that you've gotten or whatever. That could have happened. Did Israel bring their sheep and goats along on the Exodus? The answer is, yeah, they did. They did. We'll be told that later on. The flocks went with them. We have, in the not too distant future, God will say, take your flocks and herds. Many other people went up with them, as well as large droves of livestock, both flocks and herds. And in chapter 34, not even the flocks and herds may graze in front of the mountain. So even restrictions on the flocks and herds. So they had plenty of animals to go. Okay, this is chapter 9, verse 7 and following. Pharaoh investigated and found that not even one of the animals of the Israelites had died. Yet, his heart was unyielding and he would not let the people go. And this raises an interesting question. Why did Pharaoh investigate this? Well, he had been told, I will not harm any of the animals of the Israelites. And so, yeah, he wanted to go find out if that was true. And besides that, what did he learn? Besides the bare fact, yeah, say it again.
The power
of God. Because how else would that be possible if God had not sort of put up that invisible shield around the animals of Israel, unless it had been God's power? Because if you imagine the Nile Delta and all of the different, you know, divisions of the river, from section to section, the animals all died. And yet, at that one section, way over on the right, Goshen, they did not. So something happened over there. God took care of those people. All right, are you ready for a one-minute discussion? I will let anybody ask or say anything about this. How was God glorified by this plague on the innocent poor critters? They don't have souls. What is the primary purpose of the animals? Say it again.
Be used by men.
To be used to service men. Yeah. Yeah. Man is, if you see it in the order of creation, that man is the crown of creation. The animals are put on earth right before him to give him the things that he needs. To give him examples, to give Adam the knowledge that he lacks a mate, so that he has information he learns from watching the animals. The animals will provide man with food, with clothing, with wool, with leather, and other things. But more, man will learn things from studying animals and interacting with them in a fallen world. Man also needs animals as his companion. The guy, I don't know his name, but I know the years. In about 1630, piracy was already a problem in the New World. And an Englishman who had a really bad personality got kicked off of a ship. I've forgotten his name. I think his name, first name was William, but I've forgotten his last name. No. This is before them, actually. He got kicked off of his ship and shipwrecked on a Pacific island that is so obscure. I'm not sure I can even tell you the name of it today. It's not one of the more common deserted islands. It's a really obscure one. But what he found on the island was that it had goats and cats. The cats came from previous shipwrecks, because every ship in those days had to have cats. Why do you have to have cats on a ship?
Rats.
Yeah, you get overrun with rats. And this guy, no matter what he would do, was getting overrun with rats as he tried. He couldn't sleep at night. The rats were crawling all over him. And so what he found, though, was he discovered that there were cats on the island, so he raided their litters and got their kittens, and because you can't domesticate a wild cat easily, but you can domesticate a kitten really easily, and they will love you, right? So he brought in all these. He ended up with hundreds of kittens, and then they started ratting for him. So they at least kept his hut clear of the rats and stuff like that. So he learned to work with the animals. And then he learned, he was a tanner by trade before he was conscripted into being a sailor. And he was able to use the goat skins and things and stay alive until the very man who had shipwrecked him found him by accident 4 years later. So he ended up getting off of the island in the end. By the guy, he had had an argument with the captain of the ship. And the captain was so unloved that he had been demoted to first mate of some other ship. And that's how they rediscovered each other. He used the kittens to keep away the rats and so forth. I use cats for the same reason in my house. I won't tell you if I ever had a rat problem, but I haven't had a rat problem since. Boils. What's the Johnny Cash song? I fell into the ring of fire, right? Preparation H tried to use that song as their jingle. Did you know that Johnny wouldn't let them, but they wanted to. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, take handfuls of soot from a furnace and have Moses toss it into the air in the presence of Pharaoh. It will become fine dust over the whole land of Egypt, and festering boils will break out on people and animals throughout the land. Well, here are the animals in the very next verse, right? Are going to get the boils also? So where did they come from? Well, how long has it been? You know, has it been a couple of months? Have they reinvested? Have they gone and got animals? Did they steal them from somewhere? They've gotten animals from somewhere. But now the Lord's going to afflict them too. So they took soot from a furnace and stood before Pharaoh. Moses tossed it into the air, and festering boils broke out on people and animals. And I suppose the blowing of the soot would show the path the disease took. It's more apparent to people that it goes and goes and goes. Yesterday morning, I was teaching my class, and I teach in the new science lab at school. The STEM room is where I teach. And so it's got the big windows that look out on it. So, great. How do you keep a class's attention with the giant windows in a parking lot? But I try. But the kids are looking out at the window, and I'm trying to figure out what's going on. And there must have been, for a while yesterday, a high-pressure system over the city, because the smoke coming out of the chimney at the power plant for the public school, the smoke was coming up and falling directly down onto the ground. It was not going into the air at all. It was just, and it wasn't like going sideways. It was just like pouring out of the chimney and falling. What was going on with it? It was fascinating to the kids. And I suggested maybe high pressure above. You know, although it was overcast, but you know, how can that, you know, why wasn't the smoke going up? I don't know, was it heavy? But the direction of the soot was going to tell people in the same way, where are things going? How did it get there? And the magicians could not stand before Moses because of the boils that were on them and on all the Egyptians. And before this, have you forgotten about the magicians? And now here they are back, and they can't even stand there. They got too many boils, and they could not stand it. Couldn't stand has both a literal interpretation with the boils, but also a theological interpretation that they could not stand against Moses. They couldn't do this one either. And there's something significant there, because the magicians were able to do the previous ones, but now they're unable to do this one. And this is the sixth, right, plague. So at the end of the first group of three, the magicians can't do it. Now at the end of the second group of three, the magicians again are mentioned and they can't do it. So we have that as well. There's also been something going on that I haven't been bringing up, and that is that so far God has given Pharaoh and everybody else a warning. The plague has been predicted, and after this point, some of them are going to not be predicted. They're just going to come on suddenly. So That, by the way, that everybody hold up their hand this way, or like this. This, in the palm of your hand, it's called a cuff in Hebrew. Like this thing is the cuff, but this in Hebrew is your cuff, your palm, and a cuffin, not coffin, but a cuffin is a handful of anything. And that's what Moses throws up into the air, is a cuffin of soot. So it's not like bags and bags or something, but just a cuffin, just a handful, throws it up in the air. Up it goes.
Kind of reminds me of the opposite of graffiti by itself, where according to the year, it sounds like it just kind of went on and on and on and on miraculously.
Yeah.
Kind of.
But all the plagues, that's the fascinating thing about all the plagues, they're all negative. They're all destructive, right? Yeah, and the plagues of the Lord, with one exception, are all positive, right? What's the negative plague that the Lord did, that Jesus did? Where he wrecked something instead of healing. It's the fig tree. Yeah, he cursed the fig tree. But a very direct warning, yeah. Do you have something, Mark? Or just scratching? I'll call on you. So, okay. that Deuteronomy 28 says, "The sights you see will drive you mad. The Lord will afflict your knees and your legs with painful boils that cannot be cured, spreading from the soles of your feet to the top of your head." So, a reminder of what had happened to the magicians. And I mean, we've all probably had, at least in youth, a pimple. Some of you probably have never been afflicted with anything bad in your lives. You're two lovely people. But some of us probably have had a couple of these things. But whether it's been a pimple or a boil or whatever it was, it just one of them is bad enough to ruin your day. Can you imagine being covered in them from head to toe? And not from head to toe, but the soles of your feet, so you can't sit or stand or lie down, or you can't do anything comfortably. You just, no matter what you do, it's painful. But the Lord here, verse 12, the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. And he would not listen to Moses and Aaron, just as the Lord had said to Moses. So we've gotten past the fifth plague, moved into the sixth here, and now it's no longer Pharaoh hardening his heart. Now it is the Lord hardening Pharaoh's heart. Can we just, for a moment, before we probably have to stop here pretty soon, but how do we reconcile the hardening of Pharaoh's heart or anybody's heart with the doctrine of election? Well, let's be careful with the doctrine of election. Can you point to the person the doctrine of election was given for? We all can. So let's all remember that. Take your pointy finger, and let's all point. This is who the doctrine of election is for. Okay? It's not about other people. The doctrine of election is there for me. So Pharaoh maybe should ask, was I chosen by God or not? But Pharaoh doesn't think he was chosen by God. Pharaoh's fighting God all the time. But the doctrine of election, this is really a trick question. Because the doctrine of election has nothing to do with why some people are not saved. The doctrine of election is there to comfort me as to why I am saved. Why am I saved? Because God chose me in eternity to be his own. And God steered history and the church and natural disaster and my childhood and my parents and grandparents and things that happened in my past, all of that to steer me toward being where I am today in my life, in my faith. The Lord chose me because the Lord loves me, not because I earned it, not because I deserve it, but because I am his own. That's all. You've been listening to Invisible Church, the Bible study podcast from St. Paul's Lutheran Church, New Ulm, Minnesota.